just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Come the day you fly, I'm gonna teach you to fly.
I'm Kamaya.
I'm Amira.
I'm Kaya.
I'm Kamaya.
And you're listening to WPFW Washington.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What'd I
okay,
do?
Turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers having found you guilty, 10 years.
What? Come on. Get in that cell.
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find. Just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning, and welcome to Crossroads. We come to you every Tuesday at the same time here on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. We've been on air for 17 years dealing with issues affecting people who've been impacted by the criminal justice system. Again, as usual this morning, but before we start, we always open up with what we call the grapevine, information that you can use, grapevine. Hello. Virginia Prison, originally commissioned by Theodore Roosevelt, converted into a 165 apartment complex. Would you choose to live in a prison? You might. If it had been converted into a community of well-designed apartments with a clubhouse, swimming pool, green spaces, restaurants, retail shops, and even a preschool. That's exactly what's been done to an old prison in Lawton, Virginia. And I spent 15 years in that facility, and they went down there recently. And folk, it would blow your mind how they repurposed and renovated this prison. They got condominiums starting at $1.2 million and $1.4 million on the grounds of the old prison. If you get a chance, go down and check out Lawton. It ain't what we knew. It's Lawton ain't Lawton no more. ACLU and ACLU of Louisiana sound alarm on New Orleans Police Department's secret use of real-time facial recognition. Networks of fake face recognition surveillance cameras distinguishes New Orleans as the worst abuser of this technology in the nation. The American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana are raising urgent concerns following an investigation that shows the New Orleans Police Department has secretly used real-time face recognition technology to track and arrest residents without public oversight or city council approval. This not only flouts local law, but endangers all of our civil liberties. The use of facial recognition technology by Project New Orleans and New Orleans Police raises serious concerns regarding misidentification and the targeting of marginalized communities. We cannot ignore the real possibilities to being weaponized against marginalized communities, especially immigrants, activists, and Blacks and brown folks. Others whose only crime is speaking out or challenging government policies. These individuals could be added to Project NOLA's watch list without the public's knowledge and with no accountability or transparency on the part of the police department. The ACLU of Louisiana will continue to fight the expansion of facial recognition systems and remain vigilant in defending the privacy rights of all. Juvenile detention centers face one scandal after another. Despite repeated efforts at reform, allegations of mistreatment mounts at youth facilities across the country. And lastly, Maryland governor vetoes reparation bill. Wes Moore, the nation's lone sitting Black governor, diverged from fellow Democratic governors in rejecting a measure that would have studded reparations. Governor Wes Moore of Maryland has vetoed legislation that sought to make recommendations on how to remedy the harms caused by slavery and racial discrimination. A notable setback in the movement for reparations delivered by the nation's only sitting black governor. Calling it a difficult decision, Mr. Moore said he vetoed the bill because the state had sufficiently studied the legacy of slavery. The bill was a priority for the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland, which issued a scathing statement after the veto, noting that their state house is less than a mile from the Annapolis City Dock, one of the nation's earliest and most high traffic ports of enslavement. Instead, the state's first black governor chose to block this historic legislation that would have moved the state toward directly repairing the harm of enslavement. And that's been what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. We have a two-part show this morning. The first part, we'll be dealing with, we're dealing with sexual abuse in Maryland juvenile facilities. And our guest is Mr. Jeff Herman. Is a nationally recognized trial lawyer and advocate for survivors of rape, sexual abuse, and sexual exploitation. He is a trailblazer in the representation of victims of sexual abuse, devoting 100% of his practice to the cause. Good morning, Mr. Jeff Herman. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks for having me on, for the very important subject for your listeners.
Thank you for joining us. In the second half, we will be joined by our co-host, none other than the distinguished Nkechi Taifa. We'll be talking about reparations in the second half, but the first half, we'll be dealing with Mr. Jeff Herman. And this, as there's a movement going on in this location, of child sexual abuse in Maryland facilities. And I've been noticing on TV and on our internet, we've been getting all kinds of emails and ads and advertisement asking folk who've been incarcerated or confined in one of the juvenile facilities in Maryland, who've been abused while incarcerated, there's been some kind of legislation passed that would afford compensation for those men and women who were abused in juvenile facilities while juveniles in the Maryland detention or correctional facilities. That's the subject of our topic this morning. Mr. Herman is nationally recognized, and he's a trial lawyer. He's been fighting these kind of cases. And we asked him to come on this morning to share some insight. So what's the beginning of this? What's the genesis of this, Mr. Herman? How did this thing start in terms of filing a sexual abuse, even though it may have happened years in the past? That's there's right. No statute of limitation on this?
Right. So what's happened in Maryland, which has now happened in some other states like New York and New Jersey, Maryland a couple of years ago passed a new law to eliminate the statute of limitations for anyone who was sexually abused in Maryland as a child. And this is a really important law because we know that victims of childhood sexual abuse don't come forward right away. They're dealing with life. They're dealing with trying to come to terms with what happened. Many victims don't even see themselves as victims because they were coerced or groomed into the sexual abuse. And so Maryland recognized this problem and a couple of years ago eliminated statute of limitations, which was great. But as soon as that happened, the law was challenged as being unconstitutional. That fight went on until finally, February of this year, the Supreme Court of Maryland made a ruling saying the law is constitutional, and so these victims can bring their cases. Now, here's the problem. As soon as that happened, the legislators went back to work and said, okay, well, now we know there's going to be too many victims in Maryland, so we need to reduce what they can collect in their cases. These are called caps. And so very quickly, the Maryland legislature put a new law in that goes into effect June 1st of this year, which is going to reduce the caps on what victims can get in these cases. And so to give you an example, if the claims against a public entity right now, the victim can collect $890,000. That's the cap. So if a person, an adult, was molested in a state-run juvenile detention facility, which we'll talk about, Right now, they can collect, they can win $890,000. It's being reduced effective June 1st to $400,000.
Wow, half.
And for some reason, the legislature decided to give a caps for the private entities as well. And so private entities who were negligent in enabling kids to be molested in their facilities, the cap right now was $1.5 million. And it's going to be reduced June 1st to $700,000.
Wow.
So, you know, it's like Maryland, they do a great thing to enable it to come forward. And all of a sudden, before people have a chance to even bring their claims, the rights are being taken away. And so we're looking at ways to address going forward to fix these caps, because they're not fair. They're an overreaction. But in the meantime, in order for victims to be secure, they need to file their claims now. They need before June 1st, which is why we're encouraging everyone to contact a lawyer to get help, because you don't want, it shouldn't be that these caps, the new caps, will apply to your cases.
So June 1st, if you haven't filed by June 1st, you're no longer eligible to pursue this?
You can pursue it, but the amount you can collect is reduced to the new caps. And so we're busy. My firm, you know, this is all we do at Herman Law is represent victims of sexual abuse. And we have dozens of lawyers here daily just working on these cases and getting these cases filed with our local counsel, Janet Jen and Suggs in Maryland. And they're important cases. You know, we talk about, you know, why is it that we allow victims to file cases? And we look at this as helping victims heal by giving them a voice, because the only way they can get a measure of justice at this point is through the civil litigation.
Okay. All right. But one of the things that popped in my mind while you were talking is I was incarcerated as a juvenile, and I've witnessed residents being assaulted and abused by staff. And I was in a facility in D.C., a juvenile facility. And quite a few of the staff, we didn't know about gay and homosexuals back there during that time. It wasn't this prevalent. But it seemed as though that a good percentage of the staff were molesting or bothering the young boys inside the facilities. And there's nothing you can do since they got the keys and they control you. So even though they got the right to file a suit, you know, for compensation or damages, what's being done to prevent future events like this happening? Because this, at the top of the show, we read that states all across the country are rolling back reforms for juvenile justice. So what do we do? They're going to be compensated, but what can be done, or what's being done or being planned to stop this from happening to other people?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, what the benefit of being able to file a civil lawsuit isn't just to get money for the victim. It does have an impact on the future, because we're exposing institutions that were negligent and allowing this to happen. And the other thing that happens is we're exposing predators that are out there right now in our communities still molesting children. You know, one of the things that happened is in this group of cases is that there was a man named Ronald Neverden, who was working at Montrose Juvenile Facility, run by the state of Maryland. And in 1979, he was accused of molesting a child there. So what did the state do? They moved him to Charles Hickey, where he was there for over another 10 years molesting children. He was just arrested 2 months ago in Maryland after all these decades. And so here's a perfect example of how this new law protects children in the future. And so very important, because without the civil lawsuits, we can't expose the predators, we can't name them. And without the lawsuits, we can't expose these institutions who were part of the problem.
What about repercussions? If we expose our facilities, as you just mentioned about this gentleman who just got locked up recently in Maryland, he's been doing this for a couple of decades. What can be done to prevent this, or what legislation is there to make sure that we can stop this? Because I know a couple of situations where young men have committed suicide. They were molested and abused inside the juvenile facility, and they came out and were so traumatic to them that they committed suicide because they couldn't face nobody because their manhood was violated. They felt disrespected and degraded. So what is, go ahead, you got it.
Yeah, so yeah, you know, unfortunately, we see this all the time. A victim of childhood sexual abuse suffers oftentimes from post-traumatic stress disorder or symptoms of PTSD because it's such a trauma. And it's so important for victims to not have to suffer in silence, which is, again, one of the benefits of these lawsuits. This new law is that victims are coming forward and for the first times in their lives are able to talk about it and see that they're not alone. And there's like this collective empowerment. But in terms of the future, the best way to fix it is to expose the institutions because now we're focused on them. They're, you know, when you make them pay financially, all of a sudden that seems to get the attention. We saw this with the Catholic Church, right?
Yes, yes.
For decades, the Catholic Church was enabling priests to molest kids. And the same, they did the same thing the state of Maryland did. They moved predators around from church to church in Maryland institution, juvenile institution. And finally, when the church was sued and held accountable, we saw the changes take place. We forced them to fix it.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I part of my question earlier was, what about for those youth who committed suicide? Is there any redress or for those men and girls who've been abused and couldn't take it and committed suicide? So what's on the table for them who are no longer here, but yet they were abused?
Yeah. So in terms of a claim, sometimes we are able to bring claims for persons who are deceased. I mean, I've had cases, unfortunately, where cases are filed and our victim, you know, our client has taken their life because it just, they had too much trauma. Now there's rules of, there's evidence and legal issues that get involved, whether or not we can prove the abuse. And in a lot of these cases, we don't even need the victim to prove the abuse because there's witnesses. Like you just said earlier today, you saw kids being molested. So we have cases like that. And if they have family members, we're able to bring the claim on behalf of the estate for the beneficiaries, which are the family members. But mostly it's really about the victims, you know, who are out there now, maybe not yet come forward and begin to get help. And at the end of the day, I think the money is more symbolic because we can't take away what happened, but it represents a measure of justice, which helps victims heal.
Is there any part of this legislation that will address punishment in terms, because we're talking about compensating these youth, but what about the staff who abuse and violate these kids? So we're going to compensate the victim.
Yeah.
What about the perpetrator of these crimes?
So because of the Constitution, the only, and this was the issue that came up that when it was challenged, we can only retroactively change the statute of limitations for civil cases where there's a lawsuit for money. Going forward, we can fix criminal, but we can't, this law won't help with that. But even though we can't change the criminal statute of limitations retroactively, as I mentioned with this Ronald Neverden, sometimes there's recent enough cases still going on that by exposing the predator, the staff is being held accountable in the criminal justice system as well.
You know,
and as I say, we've seen in Maryland, there are several facilities that seem to have hundreds potentially of victims of childhood sexual abuse by staff. We have the Baltimore City Juvenile Justice Center, where there was routine molestation being alleged of kids. The Charles Hickey School, which I mentioned, is just, it's become the poster school for the scandal because there was so much abuse of children there. Cheltenham Youth Detention Center.
Yes, Cheltenham, yes.
Yeah, Montrose Juvenile Hall, the Montrose School for Girls. You know, they call these schools, but they weren't schools. They were lockup facilities for kids run by child molesters.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's outrageous. And, you know, I get all fired up with these cases because It's just, you take such a vulnerable.
Yes. Yes.
Right. You strip them of their rights. They're not with their family. There's no one to protect them. They have to rely on the institution to protect them. And they're just being set up. And they can't do anything about it.
Yes.
And so they become what we call compliant, meaning they have to physically participate.
That's right. They
have no choice. And then they suffer in silence for all these years. So finally, there is this reckoning. And again, it's good news, it's bad news. It's good news is that victims can bring their claims. Now, there's some personal issues there because it's difficult to come forward.
Yes.
Victims are afraid because if you think about it, talking about being molested as a child, if you have PTSD, is a trigger. It makes you bad. But when, you know, our staff at Herman Law are trained to, we understand that we help victims find their voice, you know, and help them tell their story. So they do begin to heal. But now all of a sudden, they're faced with this timeline. Oh, you better file before June 1. Many victims are still trying to deal with maybe haven't told family members yet. And there's this artificial deadline now put in by the Maryland legislature to say, oh, no, you're going to lose the case. Half the value of your case is going to be capped unless you come by June 1. It's outrageous. And again, you know, all is not lost. We intend to go back to the legislature in the next session and have them fix this.
Do you think they can extend the eligibility time on?
Yes, I think we can. And we intend to seek to do that because this is just outrageous.
You know, Jeff, I'm glad that we're talking about this because, like I said, I was incarcerated way back in the 50s and the 60s at these juvenile facilities. And I used to watch pedophiles who were working there, who was employed there as the staff. Then I go to court and my probation officer, he was a pedophile. The whole juvenile justice system, and you mentioned earlier, the priests, there's a lot of sexual abuse of youth inside of the Catholic Church. Somehow, for some reason, corrections or juvenile facilities and kids in church and the Boy Scouts and the girls, there's a prime grounds to abuse and target kids. So it should be some kind of system or some kind of check and balance in place. Because I've witnessed a lot of kids, man, who were crying and were abused. Their spirits was gone. They wanted to die, to commit suicide. When they come out, they are no longer the same because everybody looked at them as that they are less than perfect. They've been tainted. They've been abused and violated. So this trauma, even though they're getting compensation for the abuse, the act, is there any part of this that deals with the trauma, the psychological and the mental problems that was associated with being abused?
Yeah, and I think that's the most important part of these cases is that, you know, I hear from victims every day who we're representing. And by simply coming forward and being able to talk about what happened, they begin to heal in new ways. You know, I think healing, it's a journey. It's not a destination. No one's ever just healed, but there's important milestones that take place. And by being able to talk about what happened and realize it's not their fault, they begin to heal and they begin to take back control of their life. And so at the end of the day, yeah, they get money, but the money, as I said, is symbolic. What's more important to these victims is getting back control of their lives and understanding why they felt the way they felt and why they, you know, that they've acted a certain way and then it's not their fault. And then hopefully we get our clients into ongoing therapy and they begin to process it. And it's not only a benefit to the victims, to our clients, it's a benefit to society because you're healing people and you're helping them move forward in their lives. And so that's why it's so short-sighted for the government not to encourage these claims, because it takes the burden off the government. People become better citizens. They become better fathers, better husbands, better, you know, employees, and everything, you know, that trickles down from that.
Okay. We got a few minutes to go, at least 5 minutes, in fact. Is there anything that you want to say, Jeff, to our listening audience in terms of potential clients? Oh, yeah. Before I get to that, let me just throw this. Is it possible, is it too late, or is it included that everybody who files a claim on this particular issue of sexual abuse in Maryland for juveniles is a condition of it that they receive mental health counseling or therapy to make sure that they can deal with the trauma that they've been experiencing all these years?
Yeah, it's not a condition, but we always encourage that. I mean, I think that's really important. We're not doing our job if we're not helping our clients heal as best we can. But yeah, to the listeners out there, look, at Herman Law, as you mentioned, this is all that we do. We do these cases across the country. I've been representing victims of sexual abuse since 1997.
Wow.
Been doing this a long time, and I've seen, I feel blessed to be able to be in this area of law to help victims. But they can find us if they're looking to have questions and want to find out what their rights are. HermanLaw.com is the website, very easy to find. I'll give you the 800 number if people
please do.
It's 800-686-9921. Yes.
Repeat that.
Yeah, it's 1-800-686-9921. And of course, online, HermanLaw, HermanLaw.com.
Okay.
It's important that if people are thinking about it, even though it's a little bit of pressure because this June 1 deadline's coming up, I encourage people at least to reach out and ask and understand, you know, what your rights are.
Thank you. Our guest has been Mr. Jeff Herman, a nationally recognized attorney, been fighting these sexual abuse cases for years.
Ooh.
Question. Do you also deal with the misconduct of we would take this one caller. Come on. We'll take the first caller. Come on. You want to add a question or comment, please?
Got a question or comment. Great commentary today. Great comment. You always do a great job, Roach. Thank you for the conversation. But the question is, there's abuse victims that are in Washington, D.C., particularly, not going to say no names, I want to keep their identity, but they've been abused through the public school system in Washington, D.C., is there any relief for people who have went through child sexual abuse in high school, middle school, elementary school?
And this is a big problem.
My comment real quick before you answer the question is I want us to also be able to focus on the source of this. A lot of times it's an African adage, one father is equal to 100 teachers, and a father is protector. It is a protector. So oftentimes, you know, these children don't have the protection of their dad. Dad is not in the house. So
divorce,
the family court, divorce, child support, custody court deliberately remove these fathers away. The narrative is that dad doesn't want to be present. No, these courts, these judges, and not all judges, but a lot of judges have removed the dad. So we need to also focus on that, because I think that's part of the root of the problem is to put dad back in the picture, because guaranteed that a lot of this stuff is not happening to these children if dad is present and about that.
Yes.
Life. Thank you.
Yes. Go ahead, Jeff. You want to handle that?
Yeah. So the first part of the question was, first of all, just dealing with victims who were abused, not just in juvenile detention facilities, but this law in Maryland also applies to anyone who was molested as a child. It could be schools, it could be foster care homes, it could be boys and girls clubs, youth sports. So, you know, public and private schools. So it applies to everyone. But with regard to Washington, D.C., so it depends. So, again, that's a different jurisdiction. So the Maryland legislation doesn't apply necessarily to victims in D.C. Now, we do have cases where victims were placed in Maryland from D.C., so there are some potential cases there. So I would encourage people to ask, to reach out and ask. But D.C. has its own laws on this, and so they should reach out and ask a lawyer and see what their rights are in Washington, D.C. It is possible, potentially, they may still be able, depending on some of the facts.
You know, listener, thank you. That was a powerful question and comment you made. Something just popped right up in the top of my head. You said that regardless whether you was in a detention facility or you was in school or whatever, what about the kids who are in foster care? There's a lot of sexual abuse going on in foster care. Kids are placed there. So if somebody was abused in foster care, can there be a claimant on this particular class, this action?
Absolutely. And we see a lot of those cases. They're so tragic. We have cases, a little girl's taken from her home and put in foster care. So vulnerable, she's ripped from her family. And then the foster father starts to molest her. And she'll tell the social worker, and the social worker says, well, nothing I can do. Stay where you're at. Those are classic cases we get. So we represent a lot of victims who, as kids, were molested in foster homes. And if they're negligence, we can bring those cases. So, yeah, this applies to those as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Our guest has been none other than Mr. Jeff Herman, an outstanding national trial attorney, been doing this over 20 some years. We appreciate you coming in and sharing this information, and we'd like to invite you back, sir, to do a follow up piece on this, because this impacts us all. One kid get hurt, that's a kid in our community. And if we can do something to rectify that, we appreciate what you're doing. Can you give your contact information again, Jeff, before we leave?
Yep, thank you. Yeah, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Okay.
So, yeah, the phone number is 800-686-9921. And the firm online is hermanlaw.com.
Okay.
Fantastic.
All right. Thanks a lot. I guess it's been none other than a nationally recognized and outstanding attorney who's trying to rectify some of these abuses to our youth who have been in confinement. But not only that, it applies to all youth, schools, foster care, daycare, preschool. Our kids are being abused, so we got somebody on the front line that's doing whatever that's going to be done. Please keep us informed of what's happening legislatively, Mr. Herman, so that we can make sure that we can bring this to our listeners in the future.
Right. Thank you. I will do. Take
Thank
care.
You. And Merry Christmas to you, Jeff Herman.
Thank you.
Now we get to our second part of the show. We deal with national reparations, and our guest ain't no guest. She's our co-host, and she's with us. Nikita, I saw a picture of the other day. We go back from 2015. I didn't know we've been working together this long.
Hey, well, when you're having fun, it don't seem like a long time, right?
That's right. That's over 10 years. So Martine is going to come in and do the station ID.
All right.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. We are the station where you get the real deal, no jiggy boogie here. We want to share with you that the oldest African-American golf club is celebrating its 88th anniversary this year. Raymond Savoy, who was one of our guests last week talking about the Langston Hughes Golf Course, they're having their second annual, 2025, I shouldn't say second annual, Helen Wade Harris Founders Annual Scholarship Golf Tournament. But the most important thing we want to tell you is this is the 80th anniversary of the oldest African-American golf club that, along with the Langston Golf Course, was built by petitioning the Interior Department. So this is some great history. It's going to be held on June 2nd at the Country Club at Woodmore. And let's see, a telephone number. I guess you can call the station, and we will make sure that you get the information to get in touch with Raymond Savoy to attend that event on Monday, June 2nd.
Thank you. Thank you, Martine. Now we get to... We're going to throw the mic over to Nikichi. She just got back in town from New York City. Lady, every time we turn around, you're all over the world, not just the country. You're in Mexico, Canada, you're everywhere. But one thing about, I respect it, and we admire you. Lady, you are a fighter. You're on the front line. You make sure that you make your voices heard and our issues are kept in the front foot, in the forefront.
Yes.
So, Nikichi, I don't know of nobody like you. So thank you for joining us for these 10 years and plus, 10 years plus. Mm-hmm. I ain't that old, Nikichi.
It's all good. But Martine and Bobby, thank you so very much for this opportunity to just talk a little bit about this issue, which is front and square right here, right now today. And that is the issue of reparations.
Yes.
A phenomenal national reparations rally here in D.C. with speakers, with entertainment, with networking. I mean, the list just vendors, African Marketplace. But I want to bring in a colleague of mine, because, you know, my voice, I'm always in front of the mic and my voice kind of gets strained. So she's been with me every step of the way. So we're going to just be talking together with you all about what's recently been going on with this issue of reparations, and also how it relates to the topic of Crossroads, which is dealing with the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated community, because all of the dots connect. So I would like to also bring on my dear sister Jam. Her name is Jessica Ann Mitchell Abuyor. And she is the executive director of the National Black Cultural Information Trust. And she works very closely as part of the reparations movement and helps us out with a lot of things, particularly with narrative and media and the like. So welcome, Jam. How are you?
Hi, Nikichi.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you doing? Okay.
I'm good. How are you doing? Thank you for having me on.
So can you just tell us a little bit, Jam, about just what happened this weekend on Saturday, the National Reparations Rally? And I know that you were responsible for making sure a lot of youth was there, but give us a little bit of flavor and I'll pipe in as I can.
Sure. So the National Reparations Rally was held this past Saturday on May 17th. At Landsberg Park in Washington, D.C., and it was amazing. It was hundreds of activists and scholars and supporters of reparations all together, basically encouraging each other and sharing information. And it was a rally for truth and justice, for reparatory justice, for reparations, for understanding that we are in this for the long haul and uplifting the shoulders that we stand on as we continue in the struggle for reparations. We had the National Reparations Rally was supported and signed on by over 200 organizations. We had organizers coming from all across the country, from California, Georgia, South Carolina, New York, all over the place coming in support of reparations. And we had our youth activists coming. NBCI Trust sponsored a group of students from Georgia State that are a part of this organization called the Sankofa Society. And so they were a bunch of brilliant students that also came. So this was really about informing the community, bonding with the community, engaging with the community, and really getting people to know that the next generation of reparations activists are here.
And so, Jam, thank you so much for that. And, you know, we have representatives from legacy reparation organizations, such as one organization that I helped to found way back in the day in COVID, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. We had loads and loads and loads of 21st century Black-led organizations that just popping up all over the place. We have representation from state and local reparations commissions and task forces all over the country. This really nearly 100 jurisdictions have established or are looking to establish reparation commissions. We have a representation from descendant initiatives such as Tulsa, Oklahoma, or the GU-272, Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, and the list goes on. We had ally organizations. We had strong representation from the Japanese American community. We had a representative from the indigenous community, and of course, white communities as well. And we also had philanthropic support. Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, who supports the issue of reparations, was there dishing out free ice cream scoops. But this was part of the centennial celebration of the 100-year birthday of Malcolm X, which was yesterday, which WPFW had all-day programming in support of. But I just want to say real quick about how this relates to Crossroads, if I may, because with reparations, we don't just talk about reparations for the enslavement era. We talk about reparations, repair, justice, apology, amends for not only the enslavement era, but everything that's happened since then, whether it's part of the Black-white wealth gap, whether it's part of health disparities, whether it's part of educational inequities, whether it's part of the stealing and loss of our culture, but also in terms of mass incarceration. That is one of the harms, one of the injury areas of the legacies from the enslavement era, direct line from the enslavement to the Black codes, to the chain gangs, to the mass incarceration. It's all ties together the disparity between different forms of punishment meted out to Blacks versus meted out to whites. So all of this is intertwined. And I want to mention also, actually, way back in 2015, I think it was when I first started Crossroads in Chicago, Illinois, there were prisoners, detainees, who were being tortured by the Chicago Police Department. And it went on for years and years and years. And in 2015, the Chicago legislator passed a bill giving reparations to those persons who were tortured by the police department. And they required that the history and information of that torture be taught in the Chicago public schools, and they said that there would be museum and monument and things along those lines. So again, reparations is an issue whose time has come. It's not something just relegated to the faraway past. It's very much here and present. And Roach and Martine, you might have heard over the weekend something that happened right in our backyard in Maryland. I'm going to let Jam talk about that. But the governor, our dear government, Wes Moore, vetoed a reparations bill in Maryland that would create a statewide commission to study, not just study, but also develop proposals for reparations. So, Jim, can you speak to that real quick?
Yes.
Yes, this is a story that is developing. It's an ongoing story. So basically, there was a reparations bill that basically would have come into law whether or not he signed it. And he decided, instead of just either not signing it and letting it become law, or signing it and letting it become law, he decided to veto it, which is really sending a strong message that that of how much he was against this bill. Now, part of his messaging is, well, we don't want another study because the study is going to stop us from getting the work done. We could just get into the work. But part of the problem is with that is, and we had some conversations with some of my colleagues in the movement, part of the problem with that is there is no plan that we know of from Governor Moore specifically addressing reparations outside of this study that was championed by the Maryland Black Caucus. There, unless he has a reparations plan that we don't know about, what work, you know? I support Governor Moore in all of his different policies that he has done to try to help Marylanders. But we do need specific policy and specific redress for chattel slavery and its vestiges. And so this idea that by stopping the study, he's somehow championing reparations is a farce. Because that we know of, there is no laid out reparations plan, but there also can't be a reparations plan if it's not done in conjunction with the community. Part of the beauty of the studies is that during this time, this is the time where the local community from all over the state of Maryland would have been able to submit public comment and would have been able to put their input into how and why the state of Maryland needs to render reparations in its various forms. At these, during these studies and during these commissions, that is the time where community gets to have their voice in this throughout the process. Otherwise, then it's just the governor making his own decisions and not working with the Maryland Black Legislative Caucus, not working with community groups, not working with the local community to make this happen in a sufficient way.
Let me cut in a minute, because we've been doing some research on this, and it said the Black Caucus of Maryland issued a scathing statement after the veto, noting that their statehouse is less than a mile from the Annapolis City Dock, one of the nation's earliest and most high-traffic ports of enslavement. And what I'm getting at is that, I don't know what I'm getting at.
Oh, I know exactly what you're getting at.
Let me pull up. You said something earlier in the kitchen that how did this tie into Crossroads, and we deal with justice impact statements and issues for affected people. 70% of the Black population has a criminal record or arrest or confrontation with the police or the criminal justice system. So that's cops, courts, and corrections. And all of this impacts us. So I don't care if we know somebody directly or indirectly, 70% of the Black population has been justice impacted some kind of way. So it impacts. And I was surprised to find out that the Tuskegee syphilis study, those gentlemen receive reparation. The Japanese, when he interned them in the camps in World War II, they received reparation. And you just mentioned the thing about the cops in Chicago. They issued money and reparations to those folk who were abused by police brutality in Chicago. So they've been doing reparations. They do it every day through one form or another. So we need our reparations bill enacted and passed, because we haven't been compensated for nothing. We've been over-incarcerated, over-legislated, and enough is enough is enough. So this reparation program, I'm sorry we didn't attend it, sorry, Nikichi, because our niece got killed over in Landover. And it was a funeral, and it was a big, big funeral. And it just hurt that we lost six people in our family to gun violence. So these kind of pains do not go away.
That's the harm and the injury as well. We have generational trauma right in our communities as a result of unresolved issues from the enslavement era and the Jim Crow and all of that. It's been carried in our genes, and we turn on each other. I mean, I'm just saying that's part of the harm, part of the injury as well. And we mentioned Maryland, but in D.C., at the end of the year, the D.C. reparations bill unanimously passed the D.C. City Council to establish again, the same as in Maryland, a task force or commission to study and make recommendations. It did undergo the required 60-day review period in Congress. Congress did not do anything. And right now, it is supposed to be law, but things are held up because of the D.C. budget. It's held up. I mean, everything is interconnected
Everywhere you turn is jiggy boogie. I don't care what it is. I was surprised that the Virginia Theological Seminary set aside $1.7 million to pay reparations to descendants of African Americans who were enslaved and worked on their campus. This stuff is so heavy that the Native American Indians, they get partial reparations. The government has paid to various Native American tribes for the seizure of their land and the loss of income from those lands. They can't pay them enough from all the land and stuff they've taken. And these folks are being squeezed in schools, and we're being squeezed in schools. So what is it that our listeners can do, Nikichi, to participate or help move this issue of reparations along for our community?
Well, one thing is they need to know the facts. And there's one fact that they need to know, particularly here in the District of Columbia, that after the end of the enslavement era, D.C. did, in fact, pay reparations. They just weren't paid to Black folk. Pursuant to the 1862 D.C. Compensated Emancipation Act, reparations were paid to the former white slave owners as compensation for losing their property.
Ain't that so?
We don't know these things. We need to know these things. We need to know that Haiti in 1803-04 was forced to pay reparations to France in recognition of their freedom. We don't know that those payments continued all the way down through 1947, long after both the enslaved and the enslavers were dead. We don't know that in 1833, when Britain abolished slavery, yes, it too paid reparations. Again, not to Black folk. It paid reparations to the former white enslavers. And those payments, this is what's critical, those payments continued all the way down to 2015. 2015, white folk were still getting paid, okay, their descendants, reparations for the loss of their property. What about us? What is it
about us?
That we cannot get what every other group domestically and internationally, globally receive? But what Trump is talking about, reparations for the January 6th insurrectionists. In fact, they just gave reparations in a lawsuit to the family of, I forgot the name of the white woman insurrectionist.
Angela Bobbitt.
Unfortunately lost her life as a result of her storming the Capitol. They gave, I forgot how many millions of dollars to her family just this weekend.
Yes, five million.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's what we did.
I wanted to chime in.
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted, yeah, so for the state of Maryland, for people that want to support.
We have 2 minutes left. We have two minutes left. Okay.
Okay. For the state of Maryland, for people that want to support reparations, it's not too late. Call your representatives. The House and the Senate folks that are within the General Assembly can override the governor's veto. If everybody that voted for this bill originally votes again, they can override the governor's veto. So call your representatives and tell them that's what you want them to do.
Thank you.
Okay.
For information on reparations, you can go to my website, www.reparationeducationproject.org. That's reparation without the S. Reparationeducationproject.org. Back to you, Roach.
I'd like to just give a quick update about the Wake Robin Golf Club. So get your pen out. What it is, the oldest African-American golf club, Wake Robin Golf Club. This is Paulette Savoy, the wife of Raymond Savoy. Go to Wake, W-A-K-E-Robin, R-O-B-I-N, Golf, G-O-L-F.org. Wake-RobinGolf.org. And then phone number is 240-350-8270. The oldest African-American golf club, Wake Robin.
Thank you. And that's, we had the end of our 1 hour program. Our first guest was Mr. Jeff Herman. We talked about sexual abuse in the Maryland juvenile facilities. In the second half hour, it's been with our extinguished co-host, none other than Nikeche Tyfer, the worldwide traveler. And you want to mention the young lady's name who joined us, Nikeche?
Yes, her name is Jam. Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwawar, National Trust.
Thank you. And you've been listening to Crossroads. We come to you every Tuesday at 10 o'clock on the station. Thank you for joining us. And believe us, that we need to keep these kind of things going, because what's going on in the country right now, people, we got to come together. If we don't come together, we don't stand a chance. So thank you for listening to Crossroads. And again, even though the drive is over, we didn't meet our goal last week for our fund drive. So if you're listening and you want to make a donation or contribution to WPFW/Crossroads. You can, we need you, and please make a donation to keep us on the air. This has been Mertine, my wife, and Roach. Thank you for listening, and to our distinguished co-host, Nikeche Tyfer. Remember, your inner voice is never wrong. Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
We need you. Jesus comes.
Let today be the day. He'll come for the power of his name. Come, Jesus, come. We've been waiting.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Greetings. This is Papa Wabe inviting you to check out my new showgram, Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, every Thursday morning from 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We present a mashup of positive, uplifting music of different genres, mainly roots reggae. We also feature poetry, speeches, artist interviews, and so much more. That's Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, Thursday mornings, 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on WPFW 89.3 FM, making it a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Free your mind!
Freedom!
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 23rd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th, at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with films such as the U.S. premiere of Fanon and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th. Information at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
This is Rita Burns.
And this is Mason Burns. It is happening again. A celebration of my dad's legacy. The Capitol House Music Festival salutes
Sam the Man Burns. A full day of DJs and performers, including the vocalist and house music icon, Julie McKnight. A full day of joy.
Saturday, May 24th from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. at Aletheia Tanner Park.
This is an official Black Pride and World Pride event, and this event is for everyone. For more information, caphousefest.com. WPFW is proud to be a media sponsor, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Don't let that bus flash you by.
Hello, this is Faye Williams. I'll be joining the WPFW FM family every Wednesday at 10 a.m. in remembrance of Dick Gregory. We'll be talking about issues on which we all need to wake up and stay woke, as he always reminded us. We'll talk about women's rights, civil rights, voting rights, and just plain old human rights for all. We're not going to just moan and groan and complain about what's happening in our world. We'll be talking solutions and honoring those who are making important things happen. Are you ready to wake up and stay woke? Then